Hi, this is Spencer, and welcome to Rift Radio. Today we're speaking with Jessica Ostroff, a tree sitter involved with the movement to save the last old-growth forests of the Patidat and Dididat Nations on Vancouver Island. Thanks for joining us, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
So about a week ago, police descended from a helicopter to arrest you from your tree sit in a makeshift structure suspended over 100 feet off the ground in an ancient cedar tree. Tell us about the time you spent in the tree, your arrest, and how it fits into the greater project to protect these old growth forests.
So I'd been spending time with those trees for about 6 weeks at that point in time, trying to protect them since Easter Sunday. And we had started with just sort of the lower camp that the police did a lot of arrests in the first 2 days. And we were trying to figure out how we could expand that and create more. And so we went up into some of the cut blocks and started scouting some of these trees and seeing which ones they wanted to go for first and whether they really seemed protectable at all. And so that took a couple of weeks of a lot of different people contributing. And we managed to get some lines up there. We had about 7 sits ready to go. And when enforcement was announced, when we were given that 24-hour warning, it was sort of the starting bell of everything. I had actually been helping set up a different blockade camp at the time, so I had to find a back way in to get to my sit. And it was pouring rain that evening, and we had to bushwhack through the forest and fall in a river. And we got in at about 9 p.m. And I was going to head up, but some people rightfully expressed some concerns about hypothermia and being able to warm my body back up again. So we headed back down to the camp for a couple hours to be by a fire. And then around 3 a.m., we got up and headed back into the cut block. And that was sort of when that whole journey started. And headed up Big Mama at about 6 a.m. that first day. And the first 2 days were probably like the safest and most peaceful I felt in years. Those trees are so strong. They have been there for so long. They've witnessed so many things and have so much wisdom. And I was incredibly lucky because for the first 2 days, all of the other wonderful forest defenders were out keeping them busy down at camp. And those of us who were in the trees just got to really experience what it was like to be some of the only people in an old growth forest and just hear all the birds in the river and sleep after many weeks of hard work and sort of rejuvenate. And it was this eerie experience because we knew that so much like violence and fear and trauma was happening to our friends just like less than 10 kilometers away or 10 kilometers away. And we were just really lucky up there. And then on day 3, the helicopters showed up for the first time. And that was when the psychological warfare sort of started. We didn't realize at the time because we were just so focused on what was happening and moving forward and how lucky we were to get to be an old growth trees that like the things that were being allowed to do to us in there were not safe. And they were purposely doing it so that we would try to come down sooner. We had helicopters circling us 5 times a day. On the second night, RCMP were shooting sits down. They gave no notice that they were going to be shooting. We had no clue who was shooting. And they definitely shot more rounds than were necessary. They were purposely allowing loggers to come in and fell directly beside people, where it was incredibly dangerous. They weren't allowing media or legal observers in, so we had no sense of safety. And then when we were able to sneak people in, they would arrest media and let the loggers fell near our legal observers. A tree actually almost, like, it fell maybe 15 meters from landing on one of our people. And they knew that was happening. And then on top of that, there was just the whole arresting process. When they came up on, like, it was day 9 for me. I think the last time I had spoken to them at that point was day 4. It had been a very casual conversation. It was, hi, how you doing up there? You think you want to come down? No? You sure? Oh, okay.
Because you were right off the road.
I was right off the road.
You got videos where you can see him.
Yeah, so I was able to have, like, if I lifted up sort of the tarp of one of my corners, I was able to, if they stood up in the right section of road, I would be able to, like, see and holler very loudly and have a conversation with them. It's about 200 feet up that beauty. Yeah, so at that point, I hadn't heard from them in 5 days, and I'd never been read the injunction. I had not been read my rights. I had not been told I was under arrest. They didn't check what any of my safety systems were. There was no sense of caution for our lives or what was happening.
You asked us to lower down on your own volition And they didn't let you?
Yeah, I asked twice. So when they first, when the helicopter was directly above the sit, it was like shaking the entire thing. Now, it was a well-made sit. The anchor was bomber. It was checked by professionals. So I wasn't concerned about the sit failing, but they had no clue what was happening. They had people coming down through our trees. My helmet wasn't on. They were dropping branches into my sit. And when I tried to go reach for it, even though I'd already identified that I was peaceful and had no weapons on me, nonviolent, when I went to go reach for my helmet, their hand went to their weapon and said, if you make any sudden movements, we're going to assume you're going to cut our line. So I had to like repeat. I was like, I'm not wearing my helmet. You can see that. Can I please have permission to do that? So I did that. They then checked what sort of harnesses and safeties I had. I asked because I could tell one of them had no clue what he was doing in terms of tying knots. And also because I didn't want men touching me. I'd already asked for a female officer. I'd been told it was not going to happen. I asked to rappel on my own. Also because I didn't know the anchor they tied. They didn't let me see their system. I don't know that that's safe.
You mentioned and, one of the guys was being trained.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't official, but like, that's what it seemed like. He could barely tie like one of the most basic clove hitches, and the other guy was speaking him through the process the entire time. And then they ended up taking a picture of me up there for what I'm pretty sure is their memories. They told me to turn my head so I wouldn't be seen, and I heard a camera click, and I go, are you taking a picture for your memories right now? And they started stuttering and going, oh no, we have to take a picture of every system we tie to review later for safety. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. And spoke to every other sitter who was pulled out by helicopter. We were not done in all the same systems. Not a single other one of them had a system picture taken. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So next thing I was hoping you could explain is giving us a sense of the geography of the area. So you were tree sitting in a place called the Kaikuse Valley.
Yes.
There's also the Fairy Creek watershed, which is sort of the center point of the resistance.
Yeah. So the Fairy Creek watershed is the last intact watershed in southern Vancouver Island. Every single other watershed you'll go in has at least one scar or graveyard on the side of it where there's been a clear cut. So in the Kaikuse Valley, I was it was the most northern camp. And then Fairy Creek blockade is southeast slightly by about an hour's drive over loggy roads. And then to the west by about a half hour, you have Eden Camp and Eden Grove. And then near there, we also have in the upper regions, we have what we call waterfall, cloud, and ridge. And those are helping to protect other entries into the Fairy Creek watershed. There are a number of different roads the loggers are trying to access through and helicopter pads. So we have had to set up these different camps, mostly to protect this one Fairy Creek watershed to help keep it intact.
So one of the most critical aspects of this movement is its Indigenous leadership, placing it in a long tradition of resistance going back to the Wet'suwet'en standoff, to Standing Rock, to Wounded Knee 2, and countless other chapters throughout the history of settler colonialism. Can you tell us about how the guidance of First Nations has shaped the direction of this fight and what you've learned from it?
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, Indigenous leadership and old growth movements is something that's been there forever. Whether it has been acknowledged or not is another situation. And definitely in the early months of this movement, there was not enough Indigenous acknowledgement there. In the past 2 to 3 months, we've been really working as a movement to have those harder conversations surrounding decolonization, surrounding how there's no difference between the violence to the land and the violence to the people of the land, the women, the men, the children. From a Western standpoint, a lot of the time forests are looked at as resources. They're economical things. And particularly these forest plots and contracts that are given out, It's a very greedy thing where very few people are benefiting and the rest of the people are having to deal with all of the consequences, the environmental consequences, the financial ones. And it's something we've been learning is that to a lot of Indigenous people, there's no difference between any of the living beings. We are no better or no bigger than the elder trees or the animals who live in those ecosystems. And we have no right to be stealing from this land and taking their lives with healthy trees and clear cutting when they have so much wisdom and knowledge to share. And so that is a lot of the unlearning that has been going on, is reconnecting with nature in a healthy way, learning to listen to the stewards of the land, because they've been here for so long and they have the knowledge of how to protect it and how to keep it be a healthy ecosystem and a healthy community and have communication. When a community works together and tries to make sure that everybody is safe and everybody is cared for and everybody has their needs met, rather than everybody having to fight for the last dollar or fight for the last resource, there's no longer any need for there to be that sense of greed or concern, because everybody is already provided and safe for inside that community.
So with that in mind, in a public statement earlier this week, John Horgan, the British Columbia premier who was elected on the promise of protecting old growth forests and has the power to call off the logging operation, which is state sponsored, implied that a moratorium on logging this forest would be, quote, a return to the colonialism that we have so graphically been brought back to as a result of issues of Kamloops this week, unquote. Speaking of the 215 Indigenous children recently found in unmarked graves beneath a residential school. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I'm not going to speak too much on that because I know there's still a lot of grief and trauma that's being felt surrounding this new discovery. It's not a new thing because it's been happening for too long, but obviously the discovery is new this week. Him bringing that up in that context was manipulative and completely inappropriate. To be comparing the state-sanctioned murder of 215 Indigenous children and then trying to insinuate that people who are trying to stop the state-sanctioned destruction of the land are perpetuating colonialism because he's scapegoating and saying that all Indigenous peoples are the ones who want these trees brought down was a way for him to try to take pressure off of himself. And it was really disgusting, to be honest.
So after they pulled you down, they cut down the tree you were protecting, which you affectionately named Big Mama. I want to offer my condolences and ask, I heard you wrote a poem for her. Would you read it for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually wrote a number of poems for her. It was something that all of us tree sitters were doing. We started on day one because we were nervous and had anxiety and wanted to try to find ways to calm each other during the moments of stress. And so we decided each night we would start it as haikus, and then we moved into other forms as well. And then at our 10 a.m. meeting every morning on the radios, we would read each other the poems. It was really lovely. But there was one that I did not have the chance to read to the group because I was pulled down before that meeting. So I wrote this last poem on my final evening in Big Mama. I was doing some yoga. I'd been feeling very tense. And I was looking up through the canopy skylight of my tarps into her branches. And some of this poem started coming to me. So I sat down and wrote it down later. Hands and fingers reach up to the sky, feet and toes grounded to the surface, spine extended. I look up through your branches, imagining how you must feel standing tall, strong, and steadfast. Sturdy, never moving, you do not budge despite the years of winds and storms. No matter what has come and tried to blow you down, you have not fallen. Now a storm is rolling in that may be too strong, but if we can reach down and draw from your ancient strength, perhaps it is one more storm you can weather. Perhaps despite the roar of saws, we can find safety in your grounded roots one last time. And perhaps when my feet finally touch the ground, I will do so knowing that you will be safe to keep growing, reaching up to the sky.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jessica, and for your stand on behalf of the forests.
Thanks so much for having me, Spencer. And yeah, if we can just have anybody who has the time to come out, whether it's here at the protests or creating a solidarity action in your own area. There are so many old growth areas in this province that need to be protected. Even though Big Mama and other trees were taken down, there's still a lot that this movement can do.
For daily updates on the movement to save the old growth forests, please follow at Ferry Creek Blockade on Instagram or at Save Ferry Creek on Twitter. There you can find contact information for politicians with the power to call off the logging, petitions you can sign, and fundraisers you can donate to. You can also find directions and coordinates for finding the blockade camps and information on where help is most needed. We'll also include these links in the description. You can follow Jessica and see the video blogs of her tree sit on Instagram at the.active.advocate. To support the Rift Volunteer Media Project, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at rift_mag and subscribe at patreon.com/riftmag. Until next time.